I think most of you were here yesterday, so we have, I think, quite a bit of time today because I covered more. I thought that there would be more questions yesterday than half the material. So it may be desirable to start with questions if you have any from yesterday.
Sorry to get back to the history of deems and number of deems.
I mean any part of yesterday, so I'd be very happy to.
You don't mind if I get. So
I don't mind whatever the question is.
Okay, so you don't have intuition on that. But
well, wait. I said that I'm not satisfied with my intuition. I won't go that far. That I have none.
Okay, so I have a number of deems.
Yes.
And now so let's suppose I'm in the low migration deem.
Okay.
Which means that I will fixate something in each one of the deems. I will get to fixation in each one of the deem. And in the low migration limit, let's take the migration limit to zero, they might be different in each one of them, which explains in that limit why the number of deems provides an upper bound to the number of elites.
Yes.
That is the issue. Okay. So now so that one is the upper limit, and I saturate the upper limit. So now let's suppose that migration rate, I switch on the migration rate, it goes up, which means that I can mix more. So a priori, my intuition says that when I have more mixing in this among deems, the number of alleles that I fix will go down, will decrease.
Sorry, the number of alleles that you fix
will go down because I
by fix you mean that have frequency one in a deem or?
Well, at the stationary state, the number of alleles that I'm able to support will go down because I'm mixing more. Essentially, two deems might behave like a single one, so I cannot.
Yeah. Well, so
what's wrong in this? Do you have
what's wrong with that picture?
Yes.
Okay. So first of all, we have to be a little careful with the first part of the statement, that you fix something in each deem. But that's not the problem, but I just want to point out that is true if you have intermediate dominance. That is, okay. As to what is wrong with the rest of the picture, I mentioned to you, without going into detail, in one of the examples, that when you have intermediate dominance, but you have some dominance, no dominance is different. It is possible to maintain arbitrarily many alleles in just two deems. So that example then clashes with that intuition. And therefore it asks us what the intuition is. And in this case, I think I understand it. And it's simply this. You take each deem with no migration, as you said. Then, in fact, you would have only at most two alleles in the population. When Ewan and I fabricated this example, contrived it, if you like, the biological idea was simply that when you average the fitnesses, you produce overdominance. And overdominance can maintain arbitrarily many alleles. So your intuition works sometimes. I can't say how often. Maybe it works most of the time, but not always. Does that make sense in the example? I mean, I can show you the paper and the example in detail. I didn't do that again. I couldn't quite predict what people would want, and then you have more. Okay, so the way that was done is we had in mind a known random mating example. Well, I can't even tell you, where all the heterozygote fitnesses are the same and all the homozygote fitnesses are less. Okay, so let's say all the heterozygotes have fitness 1 and all the homozygotes have fitness, AIAI has fitness 1 minus SI, where SI is positive. You can maintain any number of alleles that way. It's an example due to Wright in 1949. By the way, it's kind of interesting as a historical thing. Of course, he thought he proved that there was a stable equilibrium, but the conditions for stability weren't even known then. But of course, he had the phenomenal intuition, and it's correct. So essentially, what we did is to contrive that to be the strong migration limit. Am I making any sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
One comment to this intuition. I mean, that's the general intuition one has, that with stable migration, it's easier to maintain variation than the smaller migration. And it can be proved in a number of special cases. One is two alleles and two deams, then it's true. And it's also true for a special migration pattern called the Deakin model, that it's also the stronger migration. If you increase migration, then polymorphism decreases.
Yes.
Or is not increasing.
So what's the structure of this model, this other model?
The structure of this model is slightly more general than the Levine model. It means that in each team, a certain fraction of individuals stays, and the rest of the individuals is distributed randomly over the other edges.
There's one more parameter.
That's staying, and all the rest is like in Levine.
Yes. But unfortunately, when you do that, you no longer have this reduction that the gene frequencies are the same in every deem. So it's not particularly easy. And I don't know if anything specifically is known about it for multiple alleles.
Yes. Only for two alleles.
Yeah.
That's a simple model because you can't describe the strengths of migration by just one, by a single parameter. And that was proved by Freddy Christians in 1970-something.
Can I also add a comment for multiple alleles? They just say three alleles. I think I agree with you, Tristan, about. But for three alleles, seems like this can happen. For small migrations, because we have two special alleles, which are specialized, three alleles, two of them are special. So they can be dominant in one patch each.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it could happen that a third allele can do very good when migration is very large because it's averaged. In average sense, the best. So when you increase migration, you have to switch from the two specialists to the generalist. So somewhere in the middle of the migrations, it could might happen that there's a range of migration rates that you expect from morphism. Right?
So that violates the conditions of the theorem, that model.
No, then it wouldn't be a theorem. what? Pardon me? Well, if you mean the assumptions, yes, it violates the assumptions. Yes, sorry. Yeah, Ewan is referring to a diffusion model. So there would be no upper limit on the number of alleles then, but Ewan is describing the non-monotonicity. In fact, Ewan constructed an example where there are arbitrarily many switches in the behavior. It's extremely counterintuitive. So, but yes, that's yes.
So I was going to say, can you make some comments on comparisons of diploids and haploids? Because you started off with a diploid model which was very general, and with arbitrary dominance and all that kind of thing. And that was one reason why it was hard to prove things, right?
Yes.
Whereas if you simplified down to a case with no dominance, or if you went to a haploid model,
yes,
it would be much easier, right? So
yes.
Now I just wonder whether, an interesting biological question is, why do we have diploids in the first place?
Yes.
Is there any evolutionary advantage, or is it merely some kind of a quirk of the way cell division works, or chromosome replication works,
yes,
or something, right? So, is there anything in your model that can explain why you would expect some organisms to be diploid and whether they're better or worse than haploids?
No, I don't think so because, off the top of my head, it depends how you think about this kind of evolutionary question. I tend to think about it the way Fisher did, so that I don't feel a haploid model in itself or a diploid model itself could explain it. The way I would think about it is that through modifiers, in this case of ploidy. And of course, I'm not dealing with that. Am I making myself clear? I don't know most people's background here, except for the people I know. So the way I tend to think of that type of question, evolution of recombination, evolution of dominance, or ploidy, or whatever you like, is to allow at least one gene that modifies that and see what happens to the allele that, let's say, allows you to, that affects what can happen. I have not really paid too much attention to the haploid model because it's so much less important. I'm not saying your question is unimportant, but just to do haploid genetics, in general, it tends to work like no dominance. Now, if you want something exact, what I decided not to mention, that just not to have more notation, more distraction, there's such a thing as no multiplicative dominance. So one can suppose that the fitnesses can be written as, say, UIK, times UJK. That's what we call no multiplicative dominance. Now, in a single population, that is exactly the same as haploid. That's a very elementary, well-known result. In a subdivided population, you have to be a little bit more careful because, as I said, I glossed over certain things in the lecture, and there is such a thing as soft selection, which is actually, without your necessarily knowing, is what you heard about. And then there's something else called hard selection. And you have to be rather careful because, if I remember correctly, with hard selection, haploid is not the same as multiplicative fitnesses in a subdivided population. But, and I think in soft selection it is, I'd have to just try to write it out. But in the model that I described to you, you see, I made one of my, okay. I assumed for you that the backward migration matrix is a constant. That is not true with hard selection. It's frequency dependent. It has a similar but different structure. And you know, you get into so many bifurcations in the models, I decided that it would be pretty poor exposition. So I don't think I'm fully answering your question. I don't think it would be a virtue of this model. If I were asking that question, I would certainly first ask it in a randomly mating population.
Is it soft selection the limit where the W is all close to 1?
No. No.
If it's just a technical thing, then don't.
No, it's not a technical thing. It's a biological thing. It's not a technical thing. I can put it in words or I can write equations for you. Okay, what it has to do with, you see, again, I made a choice on how long I should spend on the formulation. If you do this in detail, which is how one should, at least at first thinking about it and so on, you have to ask, what is the effect of selection on the total population number? When you're in a panmictic population, it doesn't matter. In a subdivided population, it does, because you may increase one more than the other. Okay, so soft selection means that the proportion of adults, meaning after selection but before migration in each beam, is fixed. Okay, hard selection, it's biological. Hard selection means you fix the number of zygotes and you assume that the number of adults is proportional to the zygotic number times the mean fitness. Okay, so in that case, you can't work directly with the backward migration matrix because it's frequency dependent. The equation I wrote for you is still correct, but to make it complete, you have to write down an equation for the backward migration matrix, which is well known and goes back to Moleko in a sense to 1948. Write it in terms of the forward migration matrix because you assume that. So since you're interested in the biology, the backward migration matrix, if you think about it, is a very complicated object. and it actually conflates two different things. One is the migration pattern, and one is the population distribution. The forward migration matrix just has to do with migration. See, if I ask you what's the probability that you're going to move to Berkeley, density has nothing to do. What did you say? What did you say?
Zero, but won't let that happen.
Oh, okay. I didn't know whether you were saying zero or one. Yeah, anyway. So that just has to do with the choice you make. Whereas with a fixed migration pattern, it's obvious that you're more likely to come from a bigger dim. And I just decided to formulate things on a higher level for you in order not to distract you with very, very long things. It's actually fairly complicated, and I never said anything about population regulation. But unless migration is a special kind that I call conservative, it doesn't change the dim sizes, then you have to regulate the population each generation. This gets into what I was saying, that I think the best way to derive the models is from that discrete space discrete time, because then every generation you're entitled to stick your hand in the machine, and basically you send all the people who are excessive to the basement of Lubyanka every year, and that's it. So even now, not just before. So that makes things easier. So anyway, any more questions? Okay. So as I said, I have less material, and it may be more to my thank you very much, John. More to your liking. The results are precise, but I won't be stating them as theorems. So from now on, we're just going to discuss two alleles, and only in the discrete space continuous time model, partly because a lot of this can't be done. Well, it's very difficult to do in discrete time, and one knows less. Okay, so first I want to make some general comments on it. Okay, so if we have only two alleles, we need only one gene frequency, one allelic frequency in a deem, and therefore I just need one vector, which is just the vector of frequencies of the allele A1 in each of the deems. And as we discussed then, I hope that now you're comfortable with the migration rates here, we have an equation of this form. Okay, and there are some general results we can say without specifying anything about the selection term. This is the selection term. Okay, you remember I wrote for multiple alleles a more general version of this equation. Okay, none of these results is mine. They're known results mathematically, but I decided that they were worth mentioning. And I should also say that the terminology, as far as I can determine, is not quite standard. I think of these as what are called quasi-monotone systems, but often now they're called monotone systems. And for those of you who don't know what that means, it means that if you take the vector field here and you take the partial derivative of this side with respect to, say, L, if L is not equal to K, that partial is non-negative. That's what's called a quasi-monotone or monotone system. And there's a large mathematical theory in systems like this. And we, for two alleles, not for more than two, we obviously have such a system because mu KL is non-negative when K and L are not equal. Okay, so all of these results you can get out of this book, which is out of print, but you know, at exorbitant prices still available. I didn't buy it, but anyway. So first of all, when I write this, I'm writing a vector equation. This is pretty common in this kind of mathematics, and it means that each component is greater, right? So I take one initial vector and another initial vector, and each component of this vector is greater than that one, right? Okay, it's the way you write a positive matrix, say, or non-negative matrix, m greater than or equal to zero. Okay, then if this is true, then that is true. Okay, but this has to be true for each component. Okay, second, This is, I think, an older result. This, I believe, is a result of Hirsch. There is no attracting periodic orbit. Okay? And third, if the matrix mu is irreducible, which of course generically it will be, then convergence of P of T as T goes to infinity is generic in the initial data. Okay, so we fix a mu, it's irreducible, then for almost all initial data, actually you have convergence. Okay, and lastly, if you have only two deems, so this is a system in the plane, then P of T converges and the convergence is ultimately monotone. Okay, so you don't have to say it's generic then. It always converges. In a really crude sense that I'm afraid to say, a quasi-monotone system sort of behaves as if it had one less dimension than, but I don't want, that's really vague, but in some sense that's true or almost true. Okay, so a two-dimensional, as you know, a two-dimensional dynamical system in the plane, there is Poincaré Bendix and it converges to a limit cycle or an equilibrium point, but a three-dimensional one does not. So in two dimensions, this is almost like a one-dimensional system, but I don't want to push that too far.
For part A, you don't need an irreducibility?
Pardon me?
For part A, for the comparison part A.
Yeah?
You don't need an irreducibility of the
matrix. I don't need what?
Do you?
I don't think so, but maybe I overlooked it. I thought that you don't. I think that this is true in various forms, Sue, and greater than or equal to here, greater than or equal to there, and so on. But I'm not anything but an expert on these systems, but I don't think so. But you should check his book, I mean. Okay, so one more comment. Now, if we specifically focus on genetics, then it's very well known what the selection term is, and it's a cubic like this in general, where the r's I have been assuming are constant. So if you have two deems, of course it'll converge even for any form. If you have three, then Ethan Akin proved, I already alluded to this, that an unstable limit cycle can exist. If it were stable, of course it would violate Hirsch's result, the second result. Okay, so, and that's why I said when I was telling you about the discrete time model that you don't always have convergence. Presumably you would never see it, but you don't know whether this is the worst thing that can happen. And in fact, this happens without dominance. So it's as simple a case as, it occurs in the simplest case where it could possibly occur, put it that way. Okay. All right, so now let's discuss two examples. Okay, the easy one is to take two deems and no dominance. Okay, and you can specify it this way if you like. So these are selection coefficients and only their differences matter in the equation, as you may remember. So I can take the heterozygote to have a zero selection coefficient in each deem. And then I can just set up something symmetric. Okay, so these SKs will be non-zero, and these are the two migration rates. I just simplify the notation, and you have this system in the plane. And what determines the behavior of that system qualitatively are these migration selection ratios. And I'll display the results this way. These things, to my knowledge, were first proved by someone called Island in 1971. What happens is, so you have these migration selection ratios, kappa is the sum of them, and one can display the results in the S1, S2 plane. Suppose you fix the migration rates. Okay, then you have three regions, and in the region omega naught here, which is defined by having the selection coefficients as negative, both negative or opposite sign, and kappa bigger than 1, what happens is that A1 is lost. In the sense, I guess that was questioned before, but in the sense that its frequency in the model converges to 0. And in the real world, you would lose it, or almost lose it, okay? In omega 1, in which either both selection coefficients are positive, or their product, or they have opposite signs, but kappa is less than minus 1, so that's omega 1, what happens is that A1 is fixed, okay? But in omega plus, which is this region, where the signs are opposite, and kappa is less than 1 in absolute value, you converge to a polymorphism, and it's not difficult to derive the value of that. So you converge globally to this. This is globally asymptotically stable. And in the first beam, that's the value of A1's frequency. In the second beam, that where B is this thing. Okay? So this tells you something about the biology. First of all, selection has to be in the opposite direction in the two beams. I think that's fairly obvious. And also, selection has to be fairly strong because this kappa can't be too big in absolute value. So that's what I was trying to say very briefly right at the beginning of yesterday's talk. What happens is that the environmental diversity, if selection is sufficiently strong relative to migration, allows you to maintain a polymorphism, right? Because this has no dominance. So without migration, you wouldn't, or population subdivision, you wouldn't have that. Okay? All right. Okay, one more example, which is quite a bit harder. Actually, surprisingly hard is what I thought. And that's just in a submitted paper. Now, let's suppose that A1 is completely dominant in both beams. Okay? So then I can take these two selection coefficients to be 0, and A1 is favored in beam 1, and A1 is harmful in beam 2. Otherwise, it's obvious I'm not going to get anything. Okay, so A1 is recessive, not dominant. A1 is recessive in both beams because the heterozygote has the same fitness as A2. And then I have the two migration rates, which in this case I use M1 and M2. Okay, and I assume they're positive. Because it's sort of more complicated, I use P1 for the frequency of A1 in beam 1 and Q for the frequency of A1 in beam 2. So again, I have a two-dimensional system, and it looks just like the other one, except I have P squared and Q squared. And it looks like something you could give to an undergraduate for an exercise. I had a lot of trouble with it. There are 4 parameters there. Of course, if you scale time, you reduce that to 3. But qualitatively, it turns out you need only 2. And the ones that I found to be convenient were R and theta. So R and S are selection migration ratios. And then theta is the ratio of those ratios. And those two parameters fully determine the qualitative behavior. So part of the problem is that the internal equilibrium, if it exists, satisfies a polynomial of the sixth degree. Okay, so you have to work at how many equilibria there are under various conditions and that kind of thing. And there are 3 cases. And actually, you can describe them just by looking at P, because P uniquely determines Q. And I'll describe the results for you in 2 different ways. Okay? So first, I'll show you a bifurcation diagram. Originally, I did it differently. I fixed R and varied theta. That can be done. It's not nearly as convenient. So just for the notation, in all my pictures, A means asymptotically stable, R means repelling. Okay, all of these are technical dynamical systems terms. If they're not familiar to you, just ask. And S means saddle point. It doesn't mean stable. Okay? So this is stronger than unstable. It means everything is going out, right? Okay. The three cases are theta less than 1, theta equal to 1, and theta greater than 1. The most complicated case is this one. And what happens is the following. Anything you see here is a theorem. In other words, the fact that this point is between 1/3 and 1/2, one has to prove, of course. I'm not just putting things there. And the fact that R naught is less than 4, likewise. Okay, so I just chose not to give you a huge number of theorems, but to summarize it in the picture. There are one or two aspects that I can't prove. I can't prove that p plus caret is monotone increasing, for example. Okay. So what happens is that when selection is relatively weak, then because theta is less than 1, okay, which means that selection favoring A1 in beam 1 is in some sense crudely, because there's migration in there, is weaker, then you lose A1, right? Because this equilibrium where it's fixed is repelling, and this one is asymptotically stable. And now, if you keep theta fixed and you tune the parameter R, which just think of as the intensity of selection. Just roughly think of, forgetting the migration, just think of R as the selection intensity and theta as the ratio of selection intensities, just for intuition. Okay, then what happens is that there is a critical value R naught, which is a function of theta. I don't have a formula for that. In fact, I don't have a formula, an exact formula for anything here. And I have asymptotic formulae for all this stuff, but I wasn't going to show you that. You just see a whole bunch of long equations. Okay, so when I increase R and it hits R naught, then there's a bifurcation, as the diagram shows. And for the experts among you, it's called a saddle node bifurcation. I'm no expert in bifurcation theory. Okay, so that happens at a frequency P naught, and that frequency cannot be small or large, because it's between 1/3 and 1/2. And then you have, after that, as R goes beyond R naught, two solutions, and it's the larger one that's asymptotically stable, and the smaller one is a saddle. Okay. So that's how that works. That's one way to display it. Another way, which is complementary, is to draw the phase portrait. Okay, none of these things is computed, because I think it's a waste of time, and you have to play so much with the parameters to get a decent picture. So the way I did these is that I know what the vector field does in various places from qualitative stuff, and I drew a picture that agreed with all the information. So for example, you have a diagonal here. It's easy to see that ultimately you enter the lower triangle and you stay there forever. So there are things like this. So I think it will look like this. Okay, so over here, it does exactly what that picture is telling you. There are only two fixation states, 0, 0, and 1, 1, and everything converges there. This is globally asymptotically stable. Then when you hit R naught, then you have this kind of sick picture in which you have a saddle node here, as it's called, P naught, Q naught, which is an equilibrium. And from here, you go there, but here you go out. You can write things like this in one dimension, too. It's like having x squared, x dot equal to x squared, or stuff like that. Okay, and then after you've moved beyond this very uncomfortable point, you have a thing like this. Okay, where from here, this you have a separatrix just as there. You converge to the asymptotically stable one, and from here, there. Of course, I can't give you a formula for the separatrix, needless to say. Okay, now, one remark I need to make. There are four possible pictures like this, depending on which two sides the separatrix emanates from. At first I thought that there were 10 pictures, but then I looked at Hal Smith's book more and I was able to rule out six of them. So it turns out that each of the four pictures here and the four pictures there, the separatrix has to separate 0, 0 from 1, 1. That's just how it turns out. Okay, if it doesn't do that, it's not acceptable. And that's for, that's using other properties of quasi-monotonicity, which I didn't write down for you. Okay, so these are the pictures. The simplest case is when theta is equal to 1. And in that case, for every value of r, because things are exactly balanced, you have an equilibrium. You have a unique internal equilibrium, and it's globally asymptotically stable. And the fixation states are repelling, and it starts at 2/3. Okay? And of course, then the phase portrait looks just like that. Okay? And then lastly, if theta is bigger than 1, it looks like this. When selection is below the bifurcation value, and in this case, the value at which you bifurcate is very simple, is theta minus 1. Okay, all of this comes from analyzing all the equations that I never showed you. It's a lot of work. Okay, so here you fix, this is asymptotically stable. This is asymptotically stable there. Actually, at these bifurcation points, it's not quite as elementary to prove these things. You need some center manifold theory. Also, I didn't go into it, but if you have experience, you realize it isn't totally trivial to establish in the first case which equilibrium, when you have two, which is stable and which is not, because you don't have a formula for the equilibrium. Okay, so you have to use various properties of it. Okay, so this remains asymptotically stable, and then the internal equilibrium appears, and this type of thing has two names. It's often called the transcritical bifurcation or exchange of stability. Exchange of stability because actually there's another state there, other equilibrium, which is biologically meaningless. Okay. So bigger than 1. Okay, and the phase portraits then, of course, you can see, they look like this. So here you go there, and then if you are above the bifurcation point, then it's a globally asymptotically stable equilibrium. And this equilibrium always has to exceed 2/3. You can prove that too. So it's I think it's kind of curious and in some ways not very satisfying, because this almost looks like a toy model. It's about as simple as you can get, and yet it's a lot of work to do. And I didn't say which one, all of them, or what? How does it work? Okay, so there are two reasons for looking at it. The obvious reason is you do want to see what happens when something is recessive, because lots of alleles are recessive, and it's the simplest model. But there's another one. You're not going to talk about u squared times 1 minus u, probably, or? Okay, so suppose now you were more ambitious, and you wanted to look at a population really distributed in space. Then the equation would be p sub t plus, as I said, in general, it's an elliptic operator that describes the migration. So this is an operator that depends on the diffusion matrix and the vector of drift coefficients. Okay, and the simplest case of that is the Laplacian. Okay, but because I didn't assume any symmetry, actually I should talk about a general operator. And then we have selection, which in this problem has this form. Okay, so that's the problem. And I think it's fair to say that very, very little is known about that equation, even though it's a very simple looking equation. Even with the Laplacian, the problem is not that. I mean, it's, let's just say the Laplacian. Okay, it's much harder than it looks. So it's biological intuition that the model I just described for you is a model for that model. That I cannot prove to you. But it is my conjecture that all the qualitative aspects that I described will hold for that model. I don't mean that it's going to necessarily start at two-thirds or it's between, okay? But the number of solutions, the nature of the bifurcation, all of that, I think should be the same. But that's just intuition. I mean, you don't have a diffusion model for two deems, but it is the simplest model you can construct, which might have that kind of behavior. And I think on every level it would be very interesting to understand what that equation does. And that was a part of my motivation for doing it. Okay, questions?
What's the gamma in that equation?
Pardon me?
What's G of gamma? Is it gamma?
G of X, I'm sorry, it's my handwriting. So
yeah.
That describes the spatial variation in selection, right? And the lambda is just a scale. If you don't want to scale anything the way I prefer to write it, okay, so the physicist would put a B, which is fine. My preference would be in this case to write it this way, and then sigma squared is the variance of the migration. But it doesn't matter, yeah. But we normally scale it out, and there's enormous amount of literature, not on this because it's so hard, but when you have an F of P here and make various assumptions, there's a very, very large literature on that. So if we just scale it out, then you look at it. So the lambda is like my R. And in some really crude sense, the integral of the positive part of G divided by the negative part, integral of the negative part. You understand me, right? G plus and G minus integral, that's like theta, okay? There is at this point, I think, no evidence against the idea that the model that I showed you is a model for this one, but there's also not a lot of evidence for it because we don't know much about that. I mean, I can't tell you that there, but Ewan should talk about it because he knows much more about it than I do. But we don't know the number of solutions. And I think it's likely to work much the same way. Yes?
What do people take for F of P in general?
Sorry, F of P?
Yeah. What kind of condition?
Well, the simplest F of P is P times 1 minus P, which is no dominance. In general, F of P, for us, as population geneticists, is a cubic. Okay, remember when I wrote for you P dot is that cubic function? I mean, I can pull it out again. It's that cubic function, it's the same. It's just...
You mentioned that people take general... You mentioned that...
Yes, okay, okay, yes. So there... yes. So normally what you would do is assume that it's non-negative, okay. That it's 0 at 0 and 1, because selection vanishes there. And normally you would... Okay, if you want global results, then Henry assumes concavity, right? You assume that it's concave. And the derivatives are non-zero, which is not true here. But that's, yeah.
So what if g of x is just a constant? And we presumably...
What is g, if g is a constant?
Yes.
It everything goes to one.
Right, but it's going to have a traveling wave solution, isn't it?
Oh, yes, there's a lot of literature. That's of course, the Fisher-KPP problem, 1937, yes.
Well, so the P1 minus P is the normal Fisher wave thing.
That's correct, exactly.
So are you saying that this is also an easy case with the P squared 1 minus P is also well studied, is it?
Wait, are you asking me if G is not there and I have P squared times 1 minus P, what it does?
If I understand rightly, the P squared is because it's a recessive allele, right?
Yes.
Okay, so what's the difference between the spread of a recessive allele when G is constant and the spread of a one dominant?
Ewan has to tell you, I have never worked on the wave of advance. Is that known, Ewan?
There's some work by Heath. Bersticky, even because a lot of people
work. Andy Bersticky, yeah.
What happens is that the p squared gives you trouble. The p squared, usually, if it's p times 1 that's minus p, the solution is exponential decay. The p squared gives you the algebraic decay. So the stability of the channel width is much harder. Existence, I don't think much problem. The trouble is difficulty is stability of the channel width. And p squared, the solution, because you can reduce the channel width to ODE, and the ODE solution behaves, the decay to zero becomes much slower.
But isn't there a single solution when you've got the p squared of the p? Is that the whole family of solutions?
It's a travel wave solution, right?
Well, it's a single solution.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not a whole family.
Yeah. No.
I think that's better behavior in that case.
But the stability is high because of the decay rate.
Is the velocity larger or smaller than? It's smaller, right? You can prove that it's smaller.
Yeah.
Is the velocity known for p squared times 1 minus p? Is the velocity known? The asymptote?
Because your unique velocity is some solution of the ODU. But I guess
I don't know. I don't know. You mean why it's not exponential?
Because of wave speed has something to do with the derivative.
Yeah, right. That's what I was thinking. That's why I was asking whether it's known, because in the Fisher one, from the little I know about it, it's the derivative at zero that determines the speed.
Right. But here, the long tail,
yes.
If you throw away the non-linear entirely, like the p squared, and the one linear piece, the traveling wave, has a nice exponential degree of solution, and then there's a unique solution to the corresponding ODE in moving frame. And so the unique velocity, which is the solution, is already whether or not it can be solved in simple terms or not. So it's much simpler than the normal one in this case.
But you're saying p squared times 1 minus p is simpler than p times 1 minus p?
Yes. Because the problem with the null official wave is there's a whole family of solutions.
Yes, there is, yes.
And then you have to figure out...
The speed is actually the minimal speed, if I understand it correctly.
Speed.
Right.
And there's various easy ways of understanding it, but to really show that it's hard. And
it is hard.
Very slow, with logarithmic approach and so on. This one, is you just look at the ODE, and there's a unique solution. And once there's a unique solution, then that's the answer, whether there's a question or not, and it falls with exponential in the front, and it's and fluctuations around it.
I have never seen any of the papers on the wave of advance of the recessive, so I can't tell you.
The stability is just much harder.
You don't think so? Well, I can tell you that the...
Sorry? The
Velotomies
ones with the non-linear data.
No.
I'm pretty sure.
If you set up just a simple Klein problem with a step function g, in this case, it'll have a 1 over x convergence, as Ewan was saying. And the stability problem here at zero is very hard. It's basically not fully solved. And I guess the result you have is unpublished, right, Ewan? So
that is for polynomial. They are talking about traveling waves.
Right? Yes. But I mean, I think it's all the same difficulty.
Yeah, same difficulty.
But actually, even an unbounded domain.
You realize this as p equals zero.
Yes.
Degenerate.
Yeah.
It's neutral stable.
But certainly.
We have to go to the next order to find the non-linear stability.
But what happens to the Klein, let's say even in one spatial dimension infinite domain, is not proof that it's stable. Right?
I think it's down.
Right?
Stability for the Chevy wave to this one?
No, for the Klein. It's also, even, it's I think it's not known, right?
Yeah, I know, yeah.
I think not.
For Chevy wave, it's, which is a constant for Chevy wave, they are magnetic, they are working things.
Yeah, it's... But anyway, I was motivated by that Klein problem. Because I started out being interested in Kleins, and then I eventually decided that you really had to learn a lot about the discrete case before to get developed intuition for this, because this is so hard. So, right, you understand, so the classic Klein right? Which I didn't, and actually, I don't want to go too far because it's Ewan is talking about it. But it's this type of thing, where G is positive here and G is negative there, and that. So the classic paper, the population geneticists here know, and I mentioned was the 48th paper, Paul Danes, and he looked at little field mice, it's Paramiscus polyanotus, in Florida. And it has two color forms. Actually, that was recessive. I think the light coat color is recessive and the dark is dominant. And he looked at the frequencies on the beach and in the forest. Now, he didn't do this to verify the theory. What he did was he had estimates of the migration rate, and of course he could measure decline. I mean, I don't know whether it was probably not his data that I don't remember, but it's certainly his paper. It's called The Theory of Decline. And he used it to estimate the migration rate. That's and that was the first paper on the Klein problem. I mean, the word is older, and field people had studied it, but he developed the theory sort of in the style writing down something and expanding like Taylor Sears, throwing things away and so on. That's fine. A very nice idea, and worked. So then Fisher had a paper 2 years after that in 1950, because he had gotten into numerical computation, and he took g of x to be x and just p times 1 minus p, and he actually computed a solution. You can't solve that analytically. Haldane took step functions. You know, forest and beach, so there's just a step. So he actually obtained the equilibrium analytically. It's not difficult, as you can see. Without boundaries, it's not difficult. One dimension.
Is the time problem understood with genetic drift also?
Ah, very, very good question. I have worked on it and have a couple of things. I would not want to say that. Okay, so the problem there is, first of all, the damn thing is a measured value process once you go to that, because you have a probability distribution at each point in space. So it's kind of abstract and difficult and beyond me. If you don't want to do things like that, which I didn't because I didn't feel I was qualified, then the next best thing is to look at moments. And I think if you look at that type of equation, you immediately see the difficulty. The moments don't close. Each time you get a higher moment in it. So if you look at my papers, then I simply threw away the skewness, because otherwise it doesn't close. So I had a coupled nonlinear PDE system for the mean gene frequency at each point in space and the covariances. Okay, but I could prove only very little about it. And in principle, it's possible that you can get nonsense out of that system. I mean, numerically, it didn't yield that. But I can't even prove, okay, I didn't go into that kind of thing, but all the models I showed you are biologically acceptable. If you start with sensible initial data, they'll never do anything that's nonsensical. They stay in delta JK and so on. Okay, I can't even prove that for that model. I think it's a very important and interesting model. It's very difficult. I did some numerical computation. Yes?
I suppose qualitatively genetic drift might steepen that climb. Is that roughly the behavior?
We're going back 20 years, and I can't remember, and I don't have those papers here. We can look it up. I think in that theory that I developed, there's an answer, and I'm not sure what it is anymore. I kind of gave up working on it, and that has not been taken up by the mathematicians. I think it's a very difficult system, and possibly some of them don't like the fact that I have to throw something away. I don't like it. But, I can't remember. It's So obviously, if random drift is weak, it's very close to this solution, and you just get a little noise around it. And then as it gets stronger and stronger, it gets noisier and noisier. No, I'm not telling you anything that's not obvious. Yeah. I think that's a very interesting thing. Another, I think, very challenging problem that I didn't talk about in this area is genotype-dependent migration. Okay, so let's suppose that there is a locus for heat and cold tolerance. So some alleles allow you to tolerate heat, some allow you to tolerate cold. And now we look at how the frequency of that changes, let's say between New Orleans, before Katrina if you like, and Minneapolis. I would claim that that probably has very little to do with mortality, but people's migration choices. Okay, so that's genotype dependent migration. If the people who can tolerate cold better tend to move north, to some extent, right? And south. That turns out also to be very difficult. In fact, it's highly nonlinear, even when there's no selection. But I did write something. There's not much on it. It's really hard. I know it's not obvious, but it is why it should be. It's intrinsically. You see, this is semilinear. That's not. It's just very nonlinear and very difficult. So, but in principle, that is a mechanism, and it probably is really a mechanism for a climb. So.
Can you speak a little bit about the problems with continuous models? You mentioned like soft selection, the lack of regulation of the population size.
No, in soft selection, you regulate the adults. I'm not sure what
I know Pleasant-Sinus is picking a pain in the torus of how.
Oh, yeah, that's not related to soft or hard selection. Okay, I understand your question.
Population size regulation.
Yes, so, no, that's, okay, that's a different issue, although it actually relates to some remarks I made yesterday. That has to do with the grave difficulty in formulating models when you have random genetic drift and spatial distribution. It doesn't have anything to do with selection. What it has to do with is that if you have random genetic drift in a continuously distributed population, you have fluctuations in the population size, which in a continuous time model you can't control. And so there was a certain amount of controversy about those models, and I made that remark that it is much better to look at those continuous models with random genetic drift as approximations to a discrete one. What I didn't tell you is that when you have more than one spatial dimension, we don't have a good continuous approximation. Whether one doesn't exist or whether we don't know how to get it, I don't know. I understand why, because the terms that you can throw away in one dimension, when you make the approximation, you cannot throw away in two. They remain finite. In three or more, they blow up. Okay, that I did figure out 30 years ago.
That's a just normal problem with diffusion.
So there is a kind of strange paper by Allison Etheridge and Nick Barton in which the one-dimensional problem, I'm not qualified to judge it, although I asked someone who is, maybe with occasional roughness, but essentially the one-dimensional problem is handled properly. See, it's stochastic PDE, and she's a very capable mathematician, and that's her part. And there's hand-waving in the second part, which is totally unconvincing and has nothing to do with the first part. Basically just throwing in cutoffs and so on. You don't even know that you have a process there. We just don't know how to do that.
I'm sure there's a sort of modern physical mechanics methods can do that. I mean, you do need a cutoff of some kind, but the question is you want to figure out which things do end up depending on the cutoff and how. And the trouble with all the things that don't depend on the
cutoff. Well, when you put in a cutoff, you know, you still need a process.
Right.
that is properly defined, that when you put that in, and you put it in simply because things blow up, and things blow up because you, no, the model is wrong. Well, okay, I used to live that way.
The theory of development was, it's a renovation development.
I know, I learned the, I know. Pardon me?
One knows how to do that. That's not a, I don't think it's a problem.
Well, there are a lot of sins hidden in the word one. Some people know how to do it, and it's not the best way, and most people don't, and it's yeah, I mean, I did all that. That's what I was doing, and okay, I don't know. It's not necessary. I think people have learned not to do that, right, anymore. It's not necessary to do it, I think. But maybe I'm wrong. I haven't kept
up.
I mean, it can be done without it also, right? Say electrodynamics anyway. But, right, no? Without throwing in cutoffs and so on. But, yeah, I mean, the last time I taught physics, I thought I would teach the class diffraction by a slit. And I looked at all the books, and it was all total hand-waving, and I didn't do it because in the time that I had, I could not do it and figure out. And once I was at lunch, and Nambu was there, and I mentioned this to him, he said, yes, that's very difficult. But I looked in Born and Wolf, all the top level ones, and it was totally unconvincing. You just have an integral that diverges, and you throw out the part that diverges, and so on. I could do half plane, but the slit, I never figured out. Maybe somebody did it right, but so I don't know. Everyone evolves their own way, and I have evolved from that. So, but I think that's an extremely important and interesting problem to settle. What is the best continuous approximation? But I don't know whether it has integrals in it. It can't be local or what. But I think there are some things where you can hand wave, where you have a lot of good intuition, and some things where you don't. I think this is one where hand waving is worthless. That's my personal
opinion. One way to do it, which I know works in some contexts, is you have a, you know, the space is continuous.
Yes.
But your migration steps are you have jumps, so they're not. The migration is not.
I understand you. I understand. You have a jump process. Yes.
And that provides enough of a way that you can make, I think.
Maybe. I don't know. For myself, my view was that this problem was too difficult and required, you know, really thorough understanding of stochastic processes. So what I don't like is if people who know much less are throwing things around. But you know.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Because you mentioned these migrations inside, I'm thinking, I want to ask you and also maybe the audience. So for migrations, are the movement along the sort of fittings gradient also important or not? Because mostly are just random movement, right?
Yes.
So how important are those the movement along the gradient of the fittings? Any people has done this work, or are those important biologically?
I mean, certainly once it's fired in and stochastic, then they're essential. I mean, you get things completely wrong when it depends on, balance between on the parameters and how fast migration is and so on.
Yeah.
So it changes things in the essential.
I think Ewan is asking about the deterministic problem, where they move.
But you can think about the stochastic process too, because the transition probability maybe can depend on certain, say, environmental cues, for example, or something else.
I mean, underlying any model like this, at least as I think about it, is always a stochastic process, the Markov chain of migration and so on. I think that, and I alluded to that when I tried to tell you how I think about the vector V, the principal left eigenvector. It's just that we're doing what is done in physics very often, right? We're averaging because the population is large enough, so we don't see the fluctuations. But I do think that the best way to think about diffusion or any kind of jump process is from that underlying stochastic process. You don't necessarily have to introduce it, but I think intuitively it tells you a lot.
But if you go to the linear Fisher wave, the normal one, there the stochastic parts change it by quite a lot. The small parameters 1/log of the vector's information size. the once you have a gradient in the fitness, so you can go into a region with higher fitness from where you are, then the stochastic parts just qualitatively change things. They're not, it's because you more and more get the deterministic part, more and more sort of runs away, and you can go backwards and analyze from the deterministic part what goes wrong, and see that the stochastic front completely dominates that case. So, I mean, it depends how long the gradient is and so on. If the gradient is short enough, and the, you know, one can easily estimate how big it has to be before that matters, depending on the population density and so on. So the things with fitness, with uphill fitness gradients, where you can get more and more fitness to go along, are very dangerous from some of the
So I think in terms of the noisy fissure wave, quite recently actually, it was understood what happens in the strong noise unit.
In the what, excuse me?
When noise completely dominates and selection is a weak.
Yes, I see.
Then you get a velocity that's just linear in S. Linear in the selection.
Instead of square root.
Instead of square root.
I see.
So in between the...
So there's a transition region of some kind that's very complicated.
Not transition, I mean, it's a crossover from weak to strong selection. In strong selection, you get the corrections.
You mean that you get at a certain parameter value, it just goes from square root to linear? No, that can't be.
Crossover.
Okay, that's what I meant by transition. I mean, there has to be. Yeah, okay, I'm not using it necessarily in a physical sense necessarily, but the part of the parameters.
Isn't that then just like asymmetric inclusion process, which people have used for a long time, if you take the extreme number? It gets pretty close to that. I mean, you're adding, particles can divide, so it's not quite
that. How religiously is the 315 observed? It doesn't matter to me, I'm just... you're in charge. I'm just drawing your attention to it. It's fine with me, I'm not trying to close it out. I was just...
So we're all coffee and cookies. I'm just pointing out here.
314.
No, I'm new here, so I don't know what the priorities are. If the 315 has a higher priority and one always breaks there, I was just telling my boss that this, according to that, by mine is 313. So I'm happy to stay here. I'm unable, I think, to contribute much to these questions. But I'm happy to stay here and listen and discuss it.
I was just being listening to your talk and being more of an empiricist. It would seem that most evolutionary biologists really believe that that gene structure matters.
Oh, yes.
And that selection, by and large, is local. Often is. But the difficulty of even the simple models of the kind of rich behavior. Maybe that's partly explains why, when you think about the literature, the number of cases, and you talk about all that here, where people really claim to understand or have analyzed some level of understanding how gene structure influences genetic variation of something in some organism somewhere. I don't know. How many are there? There's
not many.
It's almost a non-existent literature, even though it's very central to...
Yeah.
So there's a really interesting time scale development. Fred Cohen has done something like some field studies in various microbes and other things, microbes in Israel and so on, and looking at variability and how it depends locally on the local environments and looking at structure. But the problem is the mismatch of the time scales in which the variability is established and what's known about the time scales from mixing from one region to another. And it seems that there's the needs of things which don't mix on time scales as in the selection, but they probably do mix on time scales of genetic development and genetic variation. But at least from kids I've told people about it, one doesn't know what knows how fast that is. And people say, oh, well, soil. And the soil doesn't mix much over kilometers. But, and it doesn't mix much, but genetic variation helps very slowly. And it's and sort of patching together the times of those possibly, at least a few people I talked about it, didn't know about how that was.
Probably the number of studies is at least in the dozens, though, right? There's all the, what is it, Bradshaw and the copper mines in Wales, and There's some fish, Fudenberg. I mean, we don't. Yeah, we don't want to say there's nothing, but it's not thousands where they actually try to unite the experiment and the theory. I because of Marty, it stimulated me to say something that I forgot. So, for plants, I think it's clear that selection should always be soft and local, right? Because most of the selection presumably is occurring on the plant. And when I made the point that I like the discrete models to start with, plants are a good example, and I've thought about that some and written a little bit, because their migration is more complicated. So you, in principle, have two steps. One is the dispersion of the pollen and then of the seed, and you can do all that. And the discrete case then is more complicated. The diffusion, actually, you just have to identify things in that operator properly, and it's the same diffusion. But that type of thing is very difficult if you insist on starting with a PDE. But plants should have a really soft selection, because you have a patch and there are only going to be so many oak trees that can go there. So in that case, I think it's reasonably clear. It's
you're talking about where they're really separated completely, the deep, or where there is some migration.
No, just generally that there aren't too many really convincing studies where they are able to estimate selection and migration and match it to the theory.
Sticklebacks, I don't know how much this, but they're really isolated.
Yes, they're.
But you're saying whether there's really some migration going on, but not very much.
Arabidopsis has very strong local physical population structures separated by some
distance. And clearly the plants is very hard to estimate.
And there's
migration is hard.
But matching it to any kind of real model.
But the issue would be to
even in the case, and there's lots of instances where there's just clearly selection going on for flowering time related to sunlight. So,
The stimulus for Melico to work on these spatial models was seeing spatial variation in color patterns in a European snail, the Cypion amoralis, and that's usually interpreted as being just due to random drift and migration and mutation. And then I guess Wright developed his spatial theories, which I think are entirely opaque, I have to say, and I don't think anybody really understands them, because of the, I guess it's Linanthus Perrier flower. It's white and lilac, white and blue. Yeah. So there is some, but so he called his theory isolation by distance. I like the name, but and I knew him very, very well, but it's just not comprehensible what the process is. You know, he was so intuitive. I mean, there are the papers, and so most people, one way or another, in those have followed Melico, because you know he writes down probabilities and migration rates and so on.
I mean, the other thing which I wonder about, I don't know if many people know what's been thought through. I mean, since a lot of populations, even in environments which seem to be uniform spatially, tend to be very patchy, how they're distributed, right? People with parallels and all sorts of things. And I guess it's even careful looking at time dependence out in deserts of how various plants are distributed in controlled regions and so on. And they really this very patchy structure. And so whether the in some sense that always ends up being controlled by pathogens and sort of gets to uniform density pathogen effects or some other interpretable biology, but it seems that it enormously complicates trying to understand what's going on when the deems may be getting established not by any intrinsic relations of the environment, by something else which is playing a role in evolution as well. And so that the fact that this is separated from this is because if they were connected together, some pathogen would wipe them both out instead of just wiping out the things in the middle.
So there's some work on random extinction and recolonization, which is what that's called. Yeah. That I was, of course, assuming is not present here. So I have a fixed structure of some kind.
Yeah.
But that's very interesting, and there is some literature on that. I don't think with selection, but
dominate what things end up looking like. I mean, which is
oh, sure.
sort of how to disentangle that from the dispersal and the local selections and things. It's a real challenge unless one has some sense of what the pathogen might be or the competitor involved.
Yeah, for sure.
Think of a plankton in the ocean. I mean, very sparse, and patchy. Dispersal when things are getting mixed with frost.
Well, in any case, just thinking about molecular population genetic data, what Mark was talking about, where there's evidence based on kind of the molecular population genetics that there are traits under selection. And some of them are relatively simple polymorphisms, as you were talking about, and they have a clear geographic component. I mean, some years ago, like during the Alzheimer's era, as I said, it was a bit dangerous even speak of those polymorphs as being under selection, and so.
Dangerous because they were called, you were jumped on by strong enough, is that?
Well, but anyway, these kind of models where, you know, where there is selection, it seems like there's a good reason to go back now.
Yeah.
Selection out there.
But I have actually thought a lot about why, in some sense, why I think population genetics is a very rich and beautiful subject, but I think the progress has been less, much, much less satisfactory than in physics. And I'm not sure of the reasons, but certainly at the shallowest level, the difference is that there are interesting and important questions that one can answer with fairly elementary mathematics and physics. Two-body problem, many things in electromagnetic theory. I think a competent person can get 1 over 137 in less than an hour and a half. And that's a very fundamental result. Whereas, you know, things like what I just showed you today, which are almost like toys, are fairly difficult. And I don't know whether somehow biologists have not been as inventive, or is it because mathematics and physics have co-evolved for many hundreds of years and we haven't developed the right way of looking at it. But there is a very, very big difference, because you take selection, two alleles in a single population, and if you ask for the gene frequency as a function of time in a discrete time model, there are only some very special cases where you can do it. And there's nothing more elementary than that.
I mean, certainly in physics, people spend a lot of time doing the free body problem and then realize that wasn't the right question. And I sort of talk to people about critical things, and they said, it would really nice to solve the two locus problem in dynamics. And I say, well, you know, two locus is probably the hardest. You want one locus or many. And so there's, I mean, some amount of it is this question of which of the ones that get solved. But it seems, I mean, I would have thought that the kinds of data is also a lot of it in that, I mean, until extremely recently, all data is a snapshot.
No.
And the dynamics have to be inferred, and only now can one really start getting data where you look at the genetic changes in real time.
I don't. That's
made a lot of things.
I mean, the kind of data would influence, I think, how accurately you can confirm or disconfirm something. But this strange feature that very elementary things appear to be hard to do, I don't think is a question of the data. As I say, one way to look at it is somehow the mathematics. Another way is, I think the difficulty in the two fields is entirely different. At least as I see it in physics, the difficulty really is depth and abstraction. In biology, well, whatever words you want to use, I don't insist on, or whatever that means. I think in biology, it's complexity and variation. So somehow maybe we're not as good at handling that. You know, the number, the enormous number of parameters, and the fact that underlying everything, you're making fairly radical assumptions.
But that's connected metaphysics, isn't that also?
I don't think so. Every electron is the same.
No, but it's not.
Well, sure. There's only one electron, really. And but every species is different, and every locus is different, and every allele is different. I think, I'm not saying that it has less depths, but the variation is enormous. And I think the models are far more idealized than in physics. They're far more distant from the actual reality. That's
certainly one looks at models. People write down, you know, solid. The sort of interesting properties of solid. They're very far from reality. But the things which are developed are the ways of trying to understand which things depend upon the things you ignore and which things don't. So it seems, yeah. I think that's the part which is interesting to me, has developed much further, which is knowing which things you ignore and which are the crucial combinations of things that come in. But that also depends on what questions you ask. Now, I mean, I agree with you, absolutely. I mean, obviously, the things about it is more complex, even more variability, and which things one's interested in may be more of that, of those aspects of it. And the other bit which I also agree on is, even if I just write down the models that just look like statistical, I mean look at your comment, I mean, just look like statistical dynamics or statistical physics, and you look at them and you say, oh, I can do this in a weekend, and then you realize that they're intrinsic, a lot of them are intrinsically much harder. Even though, I mean, you know, formally they're just the same at the level of simple models with stochastic dynamics, and that's coming from the. I think it's primarily coming from, you know, in the end it's one individual that gets the mutation or has the right mating and takes over the population. And so this property that having very small numbers of individuals in the end doing everything is in the future, while there's large numbers around them interacting all the time, is at least to me what makes them so challenging mathematically, even once you write down, you know, a trivial model and what looks like a trivial model and formalize it in a way and I mean, looks coming to school, it should be easy. I don't look at your body in your head.
No, I think that's the point. I mean, but it somehow is related to the fact that you are dominated by variation.
Yeah.
In some sense. Mm-hmm. There is a way that the biological system amplifies this variation, and whereas in the case of physics, they have a tendency to be sort of obscure.
Square root of n, you know, when numbers are large, square root of n, physics in most contexts is good enough. N is good enough that square root of n is small. And in the biology, it doesn't matter, because the n can be very large, but it's one individual that gets the variation, and then that eventually dominates. So, yeah, it's